Hello and welcome to another episode of the American Soccer Analysis Show. I'm your host, Kieran Doyle, and today I'm joined by not the usual crew. Benjamin Benito Suarez Bellman is here. Harrison Homie Crow is not, but we are joined by a returning guest, somebody who came on more than a year ago now, I think. But Nico Soverhul, formerly of the Vancouver Whitecaps, Stats Bomb, Brentford. If you've been listening to this podcast, you're familiar with Nikos's work. Nikos has been doing some fun strategy consulting work with Champions League teams since he left the Whitecaps. And we thought there's been a lot of changes going on in MLS, and we thought it'd be fun to call Nikos up and see what he thinks of the new rules and the new roster things and what teams can be doing to be a little bit smarter. Nikos, welcome. How are you? How's the Netherlands?
Thank you, Kieran and Ben. Thank you for having me. I've been quite well. The Netherlands is, as most places in the world right now, very cold, very snowy, but we're managing.
Ben, I saw videos of all the ski hills at Vail and in Colorado, and it seems like an absolute disaster for you right now.
I mean, I'm not up in the mountains, which is good. It hasn't been snowing here, but the past couple days it's been like a freeze and foggy, which doesn't you like usually when it's fog it burns pretty fast, but it's been like frozen to the tree, so like the whole tree canopy of the town I'm in is white and frozen and spiky right now. It's interesting.
It is 60 degrees and sunny in Nevada, so this is not
shocked.
The weather I was promised, but I'll take it. So listen, where I think the big things to talk about today are, we've had a lot of fun transactions this summer, and we've put together a lot of really cool tools at ASA. If you've been in the patron Discord, we put out a trade machine and we put out a roster builder. Obviously, it's really difficult to keep track of. It's really difficult to keep track of all your roster designations. Every fan who's kind of into the Moneyball side of things for the league has had their own spreadsheet. And now that the league is putting out the public GAM totals, it really lets us put together a pretty fun tool here. So if you want access to these tools so you can do stuff like this and have these conversations, check out the Patreon Discord. It's $5 a month. It's really easy, and the tools are pretty good, and you get them way before they go to the main site. But on there, Akshay has very cleverly coded in the ability to swap between the two major roster models now, which, Nikos, was not a thing when you were at Vancouver. Now you can do three designated players and three U22s, or you can do two DPs, four U22s, and the extra $2 million in GAM. As somebody who used to do recruitment in the league, what do you think?
I think in general, any sort of change that allows more flexibility in types of decision-making is good. So basically, clubs can decide what model works best for them. And I think to have that ability is always a positive, for sure.
And Ben, like you were with Colorado before, and I think one of the cool things we see is that this opens up a lot of avenues for, as you said, Nikos, the flexibility where if you want to be a big spending older team like Miami, or you want to be a younger team like Colorado, who's a lot of domestics, a lot of draft picks, it opens up, even if the league has a ton of parity, there's a lot of difference in style, which I think is still interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really curious to see how it evolves. And I think it's still early days, so you can't, you know, I think what this will be the first full season. Like, I think they like had to choose their roster designations mid-season in 2024. So this is, it's going to let GMs sort of actually from the start of the year really try and tool what they want to do according to one model or the other. And I feel like most of the, you know, the contender teams are going to probably pick the 3DP model just because you can get more overall talent and more overall spots that way. But I'm really curious to see which teams are going to like lean into the GAM model. It's like max out the GAM, like you sacrifice a DP to max out the GAM. And I'm curious if you think there's like certain types of, if that's like the only thing that you can do with that, like 2DP model, or like what types of game models or club types of objectives at a, you know, high executive level lends themselves well to that 2DP model.
I would say any team that's sort of starting their rebuild would be like an obvious one, because you don't immediately want to commit to like three full DPs, because like one of the worst things that can happen Kieran, you're from Toronto, so you know the reality of this, is that you can get stuck with very bad DPs. And that is like this, a very bad situation for a club to be in, the worst one, particularly if you can't extricate yourself from them. So the like four young players plus additional GAM gives you a little bit more flexibility in the initial phase. And then at a later stage, if one of those players you buy with like the additional GAM or the extra under 22, you can always make those a DP later if they really, really hit or you sell them for lots. So yeah, that's I think a very obvious one, like clubs starting to become good again rather than teams that are trying to really, really, really win now.
It's like you're trying to cast the widest net possible to get the talent, and then
Yeah,
once you have it,
exactly.
you can build from there.
And I think there's Nico's, you made a good point there of of progressing from a U22 spot to becoming a full DP later, where there actually is a very natural progression from a squad building perspective, where you use the extra GAM now to bring guys in, and by the time their first contract is done, you don't have to deal with the fee anymore. So maybe their actual budget charge is a lot less, and you can have U22s graduate out. Like, I think in an ideal world, there's a very natural pathway between the two.
Yeah, that could definitely be the case. And also like also teams that start to become very, very attractive, like Miami are, to like aging free agents. It could also be a beneficiary in a way that maybe you wouldn't expect, because you can actually get like very, very high level talent that for other teams would be designated players, but for you would be max TAM guys. So the additional GAM could actually get you two sort of designated player level players as opposed to just one. Yeah, and
No,
of
for
course also
sure.
like those players can, or those teams can also get like really, really high level under 22 players. Like Diego Gomez is a very, very good example, who I think maybe for most teams would not have been like most teams would not have been able to sign that guy as an under 22, because he would not have come. He would only come to Miami under those conditions.
It makes me think of like Atlanta too, where with Tata, like that original drop, getting Almiron, who's the biggest sale too. So it's like if you can attract the players to then sell it on, that can even then become its own like GAM, self-sustaining GAM machine. If you can attract those talents, sell them on, and then maybe even then you can switch to the 3DP model where you're maxing GAM through player sales, which is risky, but then you can still like have the full DP flexibility as well eventually.
Yes.
I'm curious how I guess I don't want to call them small markets because Vancouver's a big place, but I would say Vancouver is one of the smaller market-ish teams in the league. I'm curious how teams like Vancouver, and actually we should ask you, Nikos, because I forgot to ask at the top. Vanni Sartini has gone. You must have a fun Vanni story for us.
Yeah, so actually the first time I was in a car with Vanny was driving. And that was sort of the first real glimpse I got of his personality, was that we were standing in front of a red sign. We were just talking, and suddenly the light flashed green, and Vanny said, "Let's see if we can die here," and just immediately steered the car straight into traffic. And I gripped my seat in sheer panic, but we made it. And I thought, okay, this is what this person is like. I enjoyed that, but it was slightly terrifying.
It sounds like him and his midfielders trying to defend in transitions. Let's see if we can die here.
Yes,
Incredible.
that is.
But I'm curious how a team like that, or a team like an RSL, where you have to, if your team isn't going to spend, maybe RSL is a bad example because they've spent quite a bit of money recently, but if you're not going to go spend big to go get Paintsill and Peck, for example, to compare to the Galaxy, I'm curious how those teams manage and how those teams choose, especially when you have guys on the fringe of designated player demo. I think the middle pack teams are really going to benefit from this.
Yeah, that could be true. Like, again, like those are exactly the types of teams that also want that type of flexibility. Like, if you have LA, if you're the Galaxy, why would you want flexibility? Just get like three high level DPs. And then you can still get, because of the money they have, still get like additional three really good under 22. Like they don't really need the flexibility. But again, like you said, a team like RSL maybe they to have like obviously the best signing that they've made is I think Andrés Gómez, who was an under 22. I could see a scenario where they think, well, we can actually sign guys as under 22s who already contribute to winning. Like Diego Luna was also an under 22 signing for them. They, I think, rightly should have some confidence in their ability to get actual like contributors with an under 22. So maybe they're a team that actually would prefer to have four of them because they can also sell them for lots of money.
And it's been interesting to see the U22 slots overall because, like you said, RSL have gotten U22s who have been actual contributors, but a lot of teams have not. Like I look at TFC's U22s have been like Ayoakinola and stuff like that. And maybe that's just a Toronto problem. But there's a few teams who have missed pretty big on their U22 signings.
Yeah, this is true. Like I actually looked at it the other day and like just how many of them would actually contribute to winning in a significant way. Like this team is good and the under 22 player that they have on the books is one of the reasons why they're good. Like that is a very short list. Like if that was the goal, that I think it's not gone particularly well so far. On the other hand, like quite a decent number of them have been sold for lots of money. So that judging by that metric, it is a success. But in terms of like, are these players that contribute to winning in a significant way, that number is fairly limited.
What
And
would oh, go for
oh,
it,
no,
Kieran.
go Ben.
So I'm curious, like if you're a team like Philly or some team that might want to lean more into their academy, like decide that the academy is the place they invest. Like what do you think is like the is there like a long-term strategy or more a short-term strategy that those types of clubs might want to pick based on like do you want to be selling or do you want to try and retain the players that you're expecting to develop? Like or would you say that both options are sort of viable? If you're sort of looking within for your talent, main talent stream.
Yeah, so if we're talking like I said, teams that are primarily based around their academy, like Philadelphia, to a lesser extent, Red Bull, those teams like that. I think you can go both ways. One, you can say like, look, we already have talent from our academy. Why are we then spending the money that we do spend on additional young talent? Like we already have it. Maybe in that case, you're better off getting like three full DPs so that they are those guys are the core of your team. And that can also then help the young guys from your academy really develop. They will provide sort of an ideal situation for the young talent to develop. Equally, you can also say, now, look, we are really, really good at developing players also when they get into our first team rather than just through the academy. Maybe you just want to double down on the youth movement and also get like really good talents from external. That like both of those things are, I think, viable.
I think one thing, and a third option there, and Craig Weibel in Seattle has said this with their team is they really want to use U22s for academy graduates who have established themselves as really good first team players. But now it's like, okay, they're going to come off the supplemental roster. They're going to have a cap hit. They're not a homegrown anymore. Do we sell them now, or can we move them into a U22? And go from there. Like someone like Obed Vargas, he signed his homegrown deal at 16. He's going to come off of that deal and is going to have a real cap hit. Do you sell him for 5 million to Mexico or whatever it is? Or do you U22 him on his next contract? You can pay him, I think it's up to like 800 grand or something like that. And you keep that guy around.
Yeah, exactly. And like this is also a good option for teams that maybe don't necessarily want to spend on guys like that, which I think might be true for Seattle at the moment, at least. Like, yeah, you can still get some cap relief. It's not that much, because like, they like how much is isn't Obed Vargas or Jose Atencio really getting?
Yeah, like
Not that much.
the maximum cap relief is 600 grand, right? Because it's a 200K cap hit, and the max you can pay them is 800.
Yeah, which is not, but that's decent, but it's not like hugely significant. It can help, of course, if you're really tight with GAM, like Seattle, I think might be. most of the seasons. So in that case, yeah, that could be an option, particularly again, like I said, if you don't really want to spend a whole lot on like incoming under 22 players, because as we mentioned, the degree to which they contribute to winning is very limited. And of course, that's a situation that Seattle know very well, because they just moved one of their under 22s in the Jesus Ferreira trade.
Absolutely. And we are going to talk about that trade a little bit later. Another thing to kind of, this isn't so much a new thing. This has been happening for a while, but it folds into the youth movement and how you use U22s and how you use supplemental roster spots. We saw two trades this draft, the MLS Super Draft, with the Union and the Red Bull trading their whole draft away. The Union traded like 3 years of draft picks, I think, to Colorado. And the Red Bulls traded their whole draft and Elias Manoel to RSL. I'm curious, Nikos. I know you and I remember you and I talking about JC Ngondo when you were still at Vancouver and some other draft prospects. And I'm kind of curious where you're at now in terms of the place of the super draft versus we just like our academy guys. And then in general, I kind of want to talk about Next Pro as well, because I think that's a thing that we've seen huge strategy differences club to club.
Yeah, so I think the primary thing that you need to think about with regards to Red Bull and Philadelphia is that I think probably the two best academies in MLS, or at least top five, and also very notably have a very clear playing style. So anyone who comes from their academy has likely been in that playing style for years and years, knows exactly what they need to do, and when they're like 17, 18, so probably already like 2 to 3 years younger than most people coming out of college, actually know how to play within that system. And you think about like the primary resource that you need to use is the supplemental roster. Like you just run out of roster spots at some point, if you want to roster most of your talent from your academy going into Next Pro, going into the first team. Like, what is the actual benefit of also going on to then scout the draft if you already have enough guys coming through the academy to fill your supplemental roster? The additional value you get from it is not very high. What I think is interesting is that you get some people going, like, well, it's very naive for like Ernst Tanner to just trade away all the draft picks because, you know, there's talent in the draft. Like, look at Moise Mobito, et cetera. And it's like, yeah, but like, there's 90 picks in every draft. Like, you're gonna find some talent. That is a different question to how likely is it that Philadelphia get a player through the draft that is meaningfully better than the guys coming through their academy. And I think Ernst rightly says that chance is very low, because Philly have a very good academy and they have a lot of guys that are coming through right now. So why bother scouting the draft, which is a very labor-intensive process, to get guys who are older, who do not know your system, and again, like have no experience at a senior level, as opposed to guys who do know your system and have played in Next Pro already.
And I think it's you make a really good point, and a point where I think like having an analytical organization is quite helpful, because if you say, okay, yeah, there's talent, it's what's the probability that the talent we do find is better than the player we have, and not just better, but is X amount of GAM that we will get for all these picks better. Where like you look at the Red Bull trade, they move Elias Manoel to RSL. They get 700K in GAM for Manoel plus four picks. And the picks are like 15, 38, and 71. And really, the second of those, the second, and then one in 2026. The other two of those picks are worth zero. They're worth nothing. They're getting thrown in for free. And so it's okay if that trade is 400K instead and you get nothing for those picks. Like, are you really going to get someone who's 300K better than Daniel Edelman, for example, who is a very good academy player? I don't think so.
No, and also, like, don't underestimate, just Philly do now not have to, effectively not have to scout college for 3 years. And like I said, it's a very labor-intensive process. Like that scouting capacity can now go elsewhere.
Yeah,
And
that's actually something I was gonna ask is if like is there a way to do data-driven scouting at the NCAA level? And like what are the challenges of that compared to like another international league that might have lower quality data or less footage? Because I feel like there is footage in the college game, but the statistics aren't necessarily reliable. So you have to, like you said, you have to put in the hours just to watch that tape and like, is it really is what's translatable stat-wise and what's translatable footage-wise from leagues where there might be raw talent that you can develop, but it's not necessarily, it feels more like a lottery ticket than like a real investment sometimes.
Yeah, it is, unless you like really specialize in it, like Colorado appear to be doing right now. But again, like that's a deliberate choice, and they've mentioned already, like Fran Taylor has said that for, I think, on MLSsoccer.com, like how much they already spent like scouting those guys, even also guys that are in the academies for other teams, don't really sign a homegrown deal and go into college. Like that is very, that's a lot of work. And again, Colorado should do that because Colorado don't really have an academy of note. They produce some talent, but really not in any way significant enough to fill their supplemental roster in a in an intelligent way. So yeah, if that's, and also they don't spend a lot of money in general. It's a little bit more now, and you're gonna need to get your talent from somewhere. So I think for them it makes a lot of sense. For other teams, maybe not so much. Like if you, I think yeah, if you don't have an academy to speak of, that's really not in any way significant. Definitely, like you need to get the supplemental roster fill somehow. And in that case, yeah, the draft makes a lot of sense. For teams that have the academy to do that, I think that they should just focus on the academy.
And the other half of this is not just the supplemental roster spots, but also you have 30 MLS Next Pro games that you've got to play 1190s every game. And this we've seen a huge, huge array of different strategies for using Next Pro. Some teams have just more or less ignored it. Toronto FC are one of those teams that they've gotten, I think Alonso Cuello is basically the only player they've gotten anything useful from their Next Pro team. But we've seen others go very, very young. They play 17, 18-year-olds max. And we've seen other teams put loads of college kids in there and they're pretty old. I'm curious what kind of what you think about Next Pro and if there's any fertile ground there.
Yeah, I think in general, one of the things that is sort of a red flag for me is that if a team has a very good Next Pro team and the first team is quite bad, that by definition means something's gone a bit wrong. Because either you have talent, like young talent in the Next Pro team, which is why they're good, but your first team is bad, so they should be playing a level up. Or you've built the Next Pro team in a bad way, where it's filled with a lot of older players who will help you win games in Next Pro, but nobody cares if you win a Next Pro game. That's not the point of a Next Pro team. It's a developmental team. So I think like Philadelphia, I think, do it the right way, unsurprisingly, being like a developmental focused organization. They're very young. Like what's really interesting, like if you look at like the just the basic stats, like expected goals, expected assists, things of that nature. Like the team, like the players that score very, very high are like the older players, as you would expect. And then there's like CJ Olney, who scores really, really high on all of those metrics. Like, yeah, and he's 16. It's like, yeah, that's why Philadelphia have a good academy, because they play those guys. They don't bother with guys who are 23, unless they're already in the system a little bit and need like a little bit more time to ripen. But like they play the 16-year-olds if they're good. And again, like there's other teams like where like the they have like the MVP of the U17 in MLS Next. But like that's, in a way, that's almost a bad thing. If you have the MVP of U17, that guy should be playing a level up, because he's really good at the level that he's at now. And I think that like that's true of like a number of teams, where it's like, why do you have an old like Next Pro team? I think it is true for Colorado actually in 2023, who I believe won it that season. And if you look at like how many guys have taken the step to the first team, it's not that many. Like Dallas now have the situation where like they won Next Pro last year. And I believe that they would agree with me, actually. That something got a bit wrong in that regard, because I think the coaching hire they made is the type of coaching hire you make when you want to integrate a little bit more youth into the academy, into your first team, sorry. Yeah, so that's, I think, again, like, it's the same type of discussion as like the draft. If you have talent from your academy, always prioritize that. But if you don't have that, like, get some draft picks. I think what happens sometimes is that players get to stick around in Next Pro a little bit too long. Like, if they're 22, 23, like, you can put them in that team for a year. If they're not ready to contribute, they won't be ready to contribute like 18 months from now. Just cut them and remove them, and replace them with younger talent. An additional thing that I think teams don't do enough of is like, it's a very obvious place to take a lot of gambles. Get guys from Central America, Australia, New Zealand, whatever, like North Africa. Like, put them there, see if they develop, and if they don't, like, they don't cost towards the cap. And only when they get to the first team do you have to pay their transfer fee, or is it, or rather, does the transfer fee count towards the cap? So it's a sort of a situation where that really sort of encourages risk taking with regards to that. And I think that's something that's really not done enough.
And we've seen that come a little bit more now. Like I think Charlotte just signed like a guy for like 2 million, and they were just like, we're gonna park him there. TFC had a Brazilian U18 guy that was kind of from nowhere, and he wasn't very good, so he leaves, and it's a no hit. I think that that using your Next Pro for dice rolls is very, very useful. And the nice thing is, if they hit, you can call them up to play 4 times. Like you get. You
Two
can play
times.
them and see them in MLS.
Yeah, exactly. And additional things, like, in terms of, like, not even like roster construction, but overall strategy, like, you can use it to really, like, hammer down on your style of play. Get like really, really extreme with your principles, because, like, why wouldn't you? Results don't really matter. This is something that we actually did at Brentford, where Flemming Pedersen was our B team coach. Later became the head coach of FC Nordsjælland and is now involved also with Right to Dream, which is the overarching organization that San Diego FC are part of. And like, we had some principles that we wanted to play throughout the organization. And like, Fleming's team, the B team, was the most aggressive in like implementing those principles. Like, we went way further there than we would ever do with the first team. Because like, for the first thing, you want to be like maybe a little bit risk averse, or at least like not take maximum risk. But like with the B team, it doesn't matter what. Just try whatever you want. Like, famously, this is also something that happened in the NBA G League when Nick Nurse was the coach of the Rio Grande Valley Vipers, which was the Houston Rockets B team. They took an insane amount of 3-pointers, like I think maybe like 70%. Because you don't know what happens if that's your offense unless you try. And it's really hard to do that in the first team, whether that's soccer or basketball, which is why you can use your B team as a sort of laboratory. And that's also a way to really hammer down on the principles, to really teach them, like, to go further than you otherwise would, to really teach those players, those young players, the style of play that you want.
Makes me think of some of the clips I would, you'd see from Leipzig when they were originally climbing up the ladder and just like going, like I remember seeing a kickoff that almost looked like an American football play where you just started off, you launch it forward like an onside kick and just crash the box. And I think one of them actually ended up in like a 10-15 second goal or something. So
Yeah, like
definitely makes sense
one
like a
example
lot.
that we did also was when I was at FC Midtjylland. Obviously, like, we were known at the time for like the set pieces, and we would, in like a youth team, would just do like, hey, what happens if we just send every single player except the goalkeeper into the box? What happens? Like, the worst thing that could happen is that you can see the goal in a game that doesn't matter. So why not just try it? And again, I think that's something that a lot of teams could like sort of use. Of course, the problem that you run into pretty quickly is that a lot of teams in MLS don't have a set style of play. So then that things become a little bit more difficult.
Well, this is why I think Columbus have gotten so much juice out of their next pro guys coming up to the first team, like Mo Farsi and Jason Russell Rowe were next pro guys. And they've had a whole collection of these like random kids come out of the next pro team, and they know exactly what they're doing in a very, very precise 3-4-3. They know exactly where they're supposed to be. And it's funny, I thought Laurent Courtois would do better at Montreal than he has done so far, and some of that's mostly they just don't have very good players. But it's been funny to see, even after he's left, Columbus too is it's the same. The kids come up and they do the job they're supposed to do.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and even if the players themselves, like on an individual level, aren't quite good enough, like they won't sink your team because at least they know how to do their job, even if they don't do it very well.
For sure. One of the Ben, do you have any other next pro thoughts before we move on to other things?
One last one, which is like, let's say you have like a promising player you think might contribute to the first team eventually, but they're starting to hit that point where there might be too good for next pro to keep developing there, but not quite right there to be a regular contributor for whatever reason. At that point, is it time to loan to a USL Championship club or another MLS team? Like, what would you say the strategy might be at that point if the organization doesn't want to give up on a player, but they still need a little more development incubation?
Yeah, so assuming here that the situation is that the first team is ready to win, because otherwise you would just play him and then help him develop. Yeah, like a loan is an obvious one. Like USL Championship is better than Next Pro. Another sort of an alternative solution could be a loan to a weaker European team. Like there's obviously a lot of like Scandinavian leagues that are not quite at the level of MLS where our player could really help that team and play against like grown men who are trying to feed their kids as opposed to academy kids. Yeah, so that is of course a solution that is worth looking at. And again, also because if those players are not already on your senior roster, you can just loan them out. It doesn't matter. Like you can use that roster spot for other things.
We've been big advocates for trying to get there to be more MLS, like intra MLS loans, but I think it's very, very difficult to get the incentives on those loans to line up properly.
Yeah, like generally speaking, like you would only loan a player, not talking about MLS, just in general, you would only loan a player if they are significantly better than what you could otherwise get. Because what is the point of developing a player and paying for him if like he only offers things that you already have or players that are like it could be like an emergency solution. Like if you have a couple of injuries, it's summer, you need like a backup right back, and I don't know, Seattle have three of them. So you loan a kid from there. That's possible. But like otherwise, like intra MLS loans, maybe only a sort of a try before you buy type deal. That's sort of like it. Like I would never loan a player, I don't think, again, unless it's an emergency from another MLS team if I don't have an option.
For sure. So the other thing that's has not happened yet, but everyone real I don't think it's official, but everyone's kind of talking about it. MLS is going to eventually be shifting the schedule from the February start date, November end date, to a kind of August, September start with a spring finish. And there's been kind of a lot of talk about how they're going to get there, which is less important. But a thing that's crossed my mind and kind of the stated reasoning for this is that it's going to make recruitment a lot easier because you don't have to deal with all these situations where it's August, you have a playoff run coming up. I want to keep the player, but the European teams are about to start their season. They want the player now. So I'm curious, Nikos, you have kind of have the experience on both continents. Do you think that's true? Do you think this is a good solution? What do you think?
I think that's definitely true. Basically, the way that it shakes out is that European teams in the summer will plan for the entire season and maybe a little bit more long term. And in January, in their sort of mid-season transfer window, it's more like remedial signings, like, oh, we have this problem. Therefore, for the next 6 months, we buy this player. Or it's like, oh, we're a little bit better than we thought we were. We want to make a push. What do we need again? What is the immediate problem that we can fix in the next 6 months? So yeah, in a situation like that, as you said, like that's not gonna be an MLS player most of the time. Like there's not a lot of really good European teams that look to an MLS player and go, this is the solution for our problem, because he comes from a lower level and will likely need some adjustment. So it's easier to sell players from MLS to a big European team in the summer. So they will have some time to adjust. They will join the team in preseason, hopefully, so that they can adjust even before they start playing official games. So that's an easier situation for a lot of MLS teams. Equally, like you said, like you don't put yourself in a situation like it is now where you are mid-season and the European teams want to spend their money in summer, and you get into a situation like RSL was with Andrés Gomes, who, like, they bought him for a little over 3 million. 18 months later, they can sell him for 10 and maybe even a little bit more. Like, that's very hard to turn down. Again, you triple your money in like 18 months. There's not a lot of owners that are going to say, like, no, like, definitely don't do that. We want to really win. We want to increase our chance of a championship by like 2%, because it's not that high, right? Like, RSL aren't likely to win the league in any scenario. But that still hurts because you're losing your best player. And again, so that situation could be slightly avoided, maybe, if you switch the calendar. And again, if the situation isn't avoided, you will end up in the same situation as a lot of European teams, where if you are able to sell your players, it will be for more money, because like teams are desperate, and you are very comfortable, so you can just say, look, we're competing for a championship. Or make a Champions League, whatever. Same as like a team in Belgium. Like, you're gonna have to overpay in the exact same way for an MLS player as you would for a Belgian player. So that I think could be an advantage for MLS teams.
And I think it's not just like the best players that I think it opens do doors for. I think it opens a lot of doors for the more mid-level sales that MLS have had. I think there's a real tier of player in MLS that is like $1 million-ish player that the teams they're going to go to in Europe, they don't have any money in January. And also the fee is not big enough that you're going to sell them in the middle of your season when they're useful to you. So now you end up in this situation where you have like a James Sands who ends up in this weird scenario where you're like, well, we don't want to move him, but he wants to move, but nobody's going to pay what we need to move him. And then he does these like weird half season loans. And so I think for that tier of player, it will be much easier for MLS to get off some of these. And some of these players have negative contract value for MLS teams. I think it will be much easier to move that tier of player now when it's like, yeah, you do the move in the summer. These teams all have their transfer budget. They can still do it, where in January they can't.
Yeah, and you can then immediately, ideally at least, replace them with the money that you've gotten as well, rather than having to do that again in January, which is your primary window, but is not the primary selling window for a lot of teams. Of course, one advantage that MLS does have in the current situation is that their primary window actually extends beyond the closing of the European winter window. So the players who maybe had hoped to go to another European team, the option is now closed for them because the window is closed, and you can actually pounce on that. So that is a potential benefit that would be lost in a change of calendar.
I do wonder if they'll keep the window longer because of just the winter climate stuff. Like if it'll be the window's open January 1st to February 15th or something like that. I'd be curious to see.
Yeah, that could happen.
Ben, do you like the calendar change? Is this something that interests you?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think it's gonna give the MLS season a little more character, I think, because it's like, you can't have it's hard to have games in the cold climates versus the sunny places, the really hot places. So I think it's gonna give the season a new feel of the arc where like games are in certain parts of the country in certain years. And I think I'm curious, like, because I think there's like the player aspect to that too. Like, do the players want to be playing in Toronto in mid-November for a mid-season game versus do you want to be playing in Houston in mid-November? And like, what if you know of like any particular, like, because I, you know, international transfers can always be hard for players. Like, that takes a certain amount of convincing. Like, there could be players who want to go to specific de destinations, or like maybe like, oh, you're in your prime. Would you consider like a major career change for an extra payday if you move to a new country where you don't speak the language? Like, what are the biggest player hangups you've seen from that side? Do you think like the calendar switch might affect that, or are there things that are unique to MLS compared to other leagues when you're having those conversations with players that you're trying to recruit?
It can be. One additional complication that's maybe not necessarily impacting like the actual negotiation, but just the performance of the player, is that guys who are out of contract, for instance, from European teams who you then sign for MLS teams, like they arrive out of shape, because they won't have a preseason because they don't have a club. And then they join your team, that team is in full swing, and they're catching up really until the end of the season. So that's a complication. And in terms of like lifestyle, again, like obviously like a lot of MLS teams, like we all know which MLS teams are attractive to guys from Europe and South America. It's because it's the same across all sports. That's New York and it's Miami and LA, and like Montreal and Minnesota, no offense, less so. That's just the reality, and they know that, of course. I don't know if the calendar change would really impact that so much, because I don't think it would necessarily impact the playing dates so much. It would just be a different, so that the season would be cut up differently. But like, yeah, like Montreal still can play at home for a large extent, large part of the season, like they do now. So I don't think
Yeah.
that necessarily would change very much.
I think the weird one is actually going to be the hot teams, where like playing in Dallas and Houston and Austin and LA and San Diego and whatever, all these places in July sucks. Like, we see it in the data that like PPDA skyrockets it in the summer because these teams die physically. They just cannot
Oh yeah,
press.
like you can see that like the like all Texas teams play a possession type style of play because you can't press because you
Yeah.
die in the summer. Like
So
Mike Fanny and me in traffic. You
Yeah.
also
So
crash.
I'm curious to see if maybe we'll see like more Scandinavian guys go to Houston or something like that. I don't
Yeah, I think
know.
they're I think they like Scandinavia already a bit, Houston.
Yeah, there have been a few from that market. Nikos, I'm curious, kind of other than the calendar stuff, like you've worked for the Whitecaps, you've worked in Europe. How different is it operating as a club in MLS in the market where I think MLS has like a little bit of a almost like a Premier League problem where it's like, oh, we know the wages are good and we know all these teams are rich. And it feels like there are guys who come to MLS for fees that are way bigger than if they had gone to, say, Mexico.
Yes, so that's the, this is definitely true, and it's also true that like the sort of the transfer fees relative to revenue are incredibly high sometimes in MLS, and I've actually thought about this a lot. Like the obvious example is like Kevin Denke, who was about 16 million from Cercle Brugge to Cincinnati, and Cincinnati have like a revenue of like what 60, 70 million, something along those lines. That is very, very high, and then I think about like. It does make sense because you can only spend your money on a very limited number of players. So if you already have two DPs, and Cincinnati do, they already had Noboto and Lucio Costa. And as we did just discussed, the under 22 players don't really contribute to winning very much, or not for Cincinnati, but in general. Like, where else can your money go? You buy Denki for 16 million. Okay, how much more are you getting for those for the, that 16 million than you would have gotten for a striker that would have cost 8 It can't be that much because some of the best strikers in MLS cost like 8 million. But maybe it is a little bit. And there's no other place for for the 8 million difference to go that would increase your championship equity. So if you're trying to win now, like Cincinnati are, because Lucho Acosta is aging a tiny little bit, and it's also make this displeasure public. So presumably they feel a lot of pressure to win now. Maybe you do just want to spend 16 million, leaving aside if like that's a good deal. It is the only way that you can spend that additional 8 million in a way that increases your championship equity. They've of course also had to move off of some guys in a trade. They traded some central defenders because they were in trouble with their allocation situation. So yeah, they are in a situation where they need to improve the team. And there's no other place to do it than to just spend as much as possible on a designated player. So yeah, that is clearly, I think, a situation that is like it is a situation that is created by the rule system in MLS.
And we've seen that a few times, especially Belgium. Belgium seemed to have been particularly savvy with exploiting MLS teams' need to put their money somewhere. Like somebody told me that Denki had had a few bids from France that none crossed 8 figures, none crossed more than 10 million. So it's funny to see Cincinnati then come and go, all right, 16, done, let's go.
Yeah, the
Like
same
if
thing
we
is
can get the
with
guy
the
we want, what's 4 million that doesn't count to the cap and comes out of a very rich owner's pocket? To get the right player, like that suddenly economically makes sense because there's no other way to spend that 4 million.
Yes, exactly. Like Hugo Kuipers is the same thing to Chicago, who went for I believe 12 million. And like, I mean, yeah, that's not a great deal. Like you can get better players for 12 million. In fact, you probably could have gotten Hugo Kuipers for less than 12 million, quite significantly less than 12 million, I think. But yeah, like again, like those Belgian teams are quite smart. They're obviously like very few leagues sell as well as Belgium do. And there's a lot of teams that sell in Belgium, like all nearly like the entire top six, seven sell for a lot of money consistently, more so than in Holland. So they know and they're smart and they know that again, like why wouldn't you just ask 12 million for Hugo Kuipers? Like the worst that they can say is no, and maybe they say yes.
I mean, Chelsea just spent 20 million on an 18-year-old goalkeeper from Belgium who has two senior appearances. It gets.
Yes, exactly. No, but like this is true for just a lot of MLS teams. One important difference is that there's a lot of parity, of course, in MLS. There is like if you sign the wrong player, the wrong DP, like it's very, very hard to extricate yourself from that, and it will impact your performance for literally years and years on end, and it can cripple a team. Like this is often something that I think a lot of like advocates for promotion relegation miss. They say that there's no consequence for being bad in MLS. It's like at least you finish bottom if you do a bad job. Like LA Galaxy had Zlatan on a non-designated player deal and still missed the playoffs because they did such a bad job of structuring the roster around him. And like then you look at like the big teams in Europe, and it's like Man United and Barcelona. Like it's hard to do a better job, to do a worse job than Barcelona. And like what's like the worst thing that can happen to them is like they finish third. So like the financial disadvantages that like smaller teams have in Europe are enormous. And this is also true for smaller leagues. Like imagine how much money you get for making the Champions League group stage. That's only one team really from like smaller countries. That's like the dynamic that you get is really interesting. So like you get, for instance, in Austria, Red Bull Salzburg win every year, make the Champions League group stage often, get a lot of money, and they miss it once. And what happens? The logic then works against them because suddenly it's Sturm Graz who have made the Champions League group stage, who got 30 million. And which team is now top of the league is against Sturm Graz because they suddenly have that financial advantage. And the same is true for FC Basel. Basel won every year until they stopped winning, and then they completely collapsed and haven't won since. So
This
yeah,
is
like
happening. This is happening in Ireland right now, where you had Dundalk made a Champions League group stage and where, like, they had more money than the rest of the league combined, recruited terribly, And now you have Damien Duff, Shelburne wins the league, and it's like the hole is now very deep to come out the other side of.
Yes, exactly. And I think that has always been to me one of the more attractive things of MLS. Like there is parity. If you do a good job, you can win. Like, yeah, obviously, Philadelphia fans don't like that, but Philadelphia do not spend a lot of money on first team players. They do invest in the academy. And they made like a ton of finals. Obviously, the Philadelphia fans will say, well, we didn't win any of them, but at least you made the final of like the MLS Cup. Like you were one goal in injury time away from winning the entire thing.
Yeah, I
And
mean,
like that's just not possible in a lot of European leagues.
no, look at the Galaxy. The Galaxy were a disaster for the better part of a decade. Hired Will Koontz, had three good windows. There was it, three windows of like really good, excellent strategic decision making to build their squad and build their squad in the right way, hire have a good coach, and you win MLS Cup as like comfortably the best team, and I think everybody would say they're one of the three or four favorites to win it again next year, and they have all this flexibility to do other things. Like, it does not take that long to be very good at MLS.
Yeah, another important difference is that we talked about already a little bit. Like it is harder in MLS to like develop young players, sell them, and then reinvest because again, like there's a literal hard limit to how much cam you get. You get a little bit of money that you can reinvest, but not all of them. Like if you let's say you already have your three DPs filled and three under 22s, one of them really works out of the under 22s, you sell him like RSL did. Okay, well you can only buy that Neil under 22 guy and you have some additional GAM. Whereas like the sort of the Brighton Brentford model isn't really possible where like you sell one guy for 10 million and then you buy four other ones for 2.5. That's how Brighton and Brentford got to the Premier League and became like a stable Premier League team. That model isn't really possible. And this is, I think, also of the under 22 initiative. Again, because you can only spend it three times, the amount of money you spend on a player like that is often very, very high. Like if a team like 2.5 million is like roughly, I think, about what an under 22 player would cost. Like any team in Europe that is able to spend 2.5 million on a player wouldn't buy three of them. They would buy eight of them. Because a lot of things can go wrong. Like we saw this in Vancouver. We had Dyber, Caicedo, Pedro Vita, and Caio Alexandre. Dyber and Caio got hurt. Like no, it was no one's fault. They both had lengthy injury layoffs. And that was it for them at the club. It's like that's like 5 million. Essentially, not entirely gone because they made both of it, most of it back, but like the and they're speculative, like transfers, and you don't really want to speculate on just three guys. That's not a model that really works. That's not how it works in Europe. You want to spread out the risk.
And I think it keeps coming back to the rules and like, the context of MLS starting as a league that just wanted to make sure it could survive its first 20 years of existence as, not to overspend. So like whenever there's the opportunity to overspend in like the more European financial free model where you don't have these roster restrictions or spending restrictions to the same degree for, 95% of clubs. With MLS, you're intentionally pulling that back, distributing the risk across the other teams. You have that, LA is now having to lose so many good players that were key to their run because of this, penalty for winning within MLS. But that's just a consequence of that. You're spreading the risk, you're spreading the talent, you're making sure that no one team can put the rest of the league in a hole by, by doing an NASL and causing the league to implode. So that's sort of what you're trading off is the ability for these great teams to run off, crazy things, although it happened with DC and LA from time to time. But in the long run, you're enabling that, like you're saying, you're enabling them to not get out in front of their skis and not like spend themselves into oblivion and keep the roster small and, organized. And that's now the skill in MLS is you have to be able to balance that if you're going to maximize your talent. It's not about the amount of money you're capable of spending to the same degree.
No, I mean, obviously, Atlanta United are a very clear example of it. Like they had Thiago Almada, who I think no other team could have bought at that point in terms of like MLS. And individually, he did quite well. I think one young player of the year was, I think, top three in MVP. And what did the team do? Nothing. Atlanta did nothing while he was there, which I think is a very good example of like the system working as intended in a way. Like even if you get like the really, really top level talent no other team can get, it still doesn't guarantee results. Like you cannot spend your way to a title, not really.
Yeah, then they sell Almada and then beat Messi in the playoffs. So that's how
Yeah, that
that's
was
supposed to
quite
work
funny.
here.
And that Almada deal is after they bought PT Martinez, who like scored the winner in the Libertadores final, like was one of the best players in South America right before that. I think sometimes MLS might have too much parity, but I think it's very safe to say that it keeps things from getting too out of control, I think. We'll see.
It
We'll see what
doesn't like
Miami
there's
does with all their gam.
yeah we'll see there are already like structural advantages and disadvantages that teams have that I think maybe people aren't fully aware of. Like there's like income tax is a very obvious one. Players can just objectively make more money in like Nashville than they can in Vancouver, for instance.
If you look at the NHL, which it's the same things, I think the last 12 winners or something are all in the bottom quartile for income tax in the league because they just have
Lightning,
better.
baby.
Because, yeah, the Tampa Bay Lightning, the Vegas Golden Knights, like these teams all have very, very low tax rates. And if you're a free agent who can make $13 million a year in Tampa, or you can make effectively $9 million in Toronto with the same free agent, like that's, you're not going to go to Toronto. The endorsements don't make it up.
No, exactly. And then
Let's move on because I don't want to take up too much of your time. We've had a lot of fun deals, a lot of fun trades, a lot of honestly quite surprising trades. And we had a lot of hot takes in the playoffs, so we're bringing more hot takes back. So Ben and Nikos, I'm going to give you guys five transactions, and I want you to rank them between like give it a rating of like a 1 to 10. 10 being it's a huge win for the buyer, 1 being it's a huge win for the seller. You should never have made that deal. You're a dumb team. And we'll start with probably the biggest trade of the offseason. Jesus Ferreira goes to Seattle, $2 million in GAM. It's spread over 3 seasons. And they also send a 2025 international slot and Leo Chu to FC Dallas. Nikos, 1 to 10. What's your vibe on that trade for Seattle?
like six maybe. Like I think Chris Ferreira is very good. Had a bit of a down year. I think I like it less for Dallas also because of the history. Like they have Ferreira give him a designated player deal. And this is I think a very important thing to note. Like the moment a player becomes a designated player, he has to be really good to still get a move to Europe because you're paying him like 2 million. Again, in a state with no income tax. And there's not a lot of teams that can just pay a player 2 million. Again, on top of, again, the teams in Europe, that is. Like, obviously for the very, very good teams, but like, that guy isn't going to go to Belgium. That guy isn't going to go to Holland unless he's really good. And then they sign Pedro Musa for a lot of money and sort of find out that those guys don't really play together very well. So it feels like they've sort of got themselves in a situation where they now have to do a like suboptimal deal really to get out from under it. But like obviously it's still like a huge amount of GAM given the situation they're in. And I think Zanotta has of course better connections in Brazil than most other like chief soccer officers in MLS and can likely sell Leo Chu for more money than other GMs would. So I like that part of it.
And a fun thing that we found out about this deal that I don't think has been made public yet, Leo Chu is on an option year, so he can be converted off of a U22, which means Dallas can record all of the GAM from any eventual sale. They're not restricted by the U22 sale rules on this. So like a very sneaky, quite smart cap deal on that side. Ben, how do you rate this one?
Yeah, I think I'm with Nikos. I'm gonna push it to a seven, just not to slight Dallas, like, oh, they shouldn't have made this move, because I think they had to, and I think their options were so limited. But I think also Seattle's options to get a player of this caliber who's great but not necessarily the main piece can just like really contribute in a really talented team like Seattle has without having to spend big transfer fees, just using those in-league mechanisms. I think it was a really smart way to get a solid piece that can be a fixture in Seattle for many years to come. So I think it's a good win now move, and I think it's a very smart maximize what you have now for the future type of move as well. So
Yes,
I
I
think
saw it.
it's, and just to convince him to take less money, I assume for a longer contract, but like having to convince Ferreira to take a different type of deal to make it work within Seattle showed that they worked that negotiation really well to make the comfort player feel comfortable with that. So
Yes, and also like Seattle, like I mentioned before, appear to be right now in a situation where they don't really want to spend a lot of money on transfer fees. So I think for them to find this sort of alternative solution, it's quite good.
I would also have it somewhere 6-7, probably. I'd lean 7 because the GAM comes over so long. I think that's quite attractive to me. And then the TAM renegotiation on the contract is very, very attractive. Another deal. These are two deals kind of combined. Anderson Julio moves from RSL to FC Dallas for Sam Junkwa, 400K guaranteed GAM and 100K in incentives. Tied to that is Elias Manuel and the four draft picks from NYRB to RSL for 700K in GAM. From the RSL perspective, Ben, love, hate, what do you think about this one?
I love it. I think this is a really good move for RSL in terms of trying to reload after being really good and then faltering a bit. I don't like Anderson Julio. Whenever I would watch RSL's games against Colorado, he feels like he's got a lot of flash, but he never really gelled with that team. So I don't get the sense that they're losing a whole bunch. And I'm not really sure what FC Dallas is going to be getting from this trade. So I think it makes a lot of sense for New York to dump their draft picks if they just want to, double down on the academy. I think it's a really good deal for RSL, and I'm a little iffy on it for Dallas.
Nikos, where are you at on this deal for RSL specifically? These two deals, I guess.
For RSL, I think it's like a straight upgrade. So I'd say 7, 8. I quite like Elias Manuel. So like Julio is, I think, a perfectly fine player, but like doesn't really move the needle. And you can get like a fairly young still Manuel player, who I think is quite good. So I again fully in support of this move by RSL.
I think if you look at this trade as you pay 300K to upgrade from Julio to Manuel, and you get Junkwa and four draft picks, given the geographic constraints you have with your academy, to me it's a no-brainer. I would have this kind of 8 or 9 for RSL. I don't really like Anderson Julio, and I do quite like Elias Manuel. I'm very curious how they're gonna play. Like, this screams we're gonna play two strikers to me with him and Chicho. Which they kind of did sometimes last season, but I'm quite curious to see what they're doing. It's a shame Harrison isn't here. I'm sure he'd have some good RSL takes on this one. Next deal. This one I think is the most interesting deal. Gaston Brugman goes to Nashville for Sean Davis and 100K in GAM. Nashville retains some portion of Sean Davis's salary. I don't think it's been reported how much they're retaining, so let's just assume half. But I think a lot of your grade on this will depend on what the number they're retaining is.
Are we judging it for the Galaxy or for
Yeah,
Nashville?
let's go for the Galaxy. Nashville are boring. Nobody cares about them.
I mean, four. Like, obviously, I think the team gets worse, which that's not what you want if you just won MLS Cup. But I think also, like, it was necessary. So, okay, they have to do it. This is why it's not like a huge negative, but you still get worse. One of the negatives that I see in this deal for the Galaxy is also that Sean Davis fell a little bit more out of the rotation after the coaching change in Nashville and the style of play changed to a more possession-oriented style. So my assumption would be that he's going to fit not very well in what the galaxy are doing, because they're even more possession oriented. I don't think he's ever really shown the ability to play in a possession type style. I really like Sean Davis as a player, but that would be a question that I have. Again, like, you're losing the MLS Cup Final MVP for a guy who struggles in a possession team. That's
It's
not ideal.
a very, and why I say this is the most in, one of the most interesting trades is like, that's exactly it. Is you look at Brugman, and Brugman's only flaw over the last 3 years has been his ability to stay on the field. And you go into the last year of this deal where he makes a lot of money, and maybe it's a fair decision to say we're going to move on from him. I think if you say it's half of Davis's cap it is getting picked up, he makes something like $1 million now, which, by the way, feels like a crazy contract for him. But
Yeah, he was a free agent, like, in his prime, and also coming off of, like, being the Red Bull captain.
we love Sean Davis. Sean Davis came on and did a pod here a few years ago to talk about Red Bulls and analytics and how they had ASA articles in his locker, which I thought was cool. But I'm very curious to see if this comes with a later move for the Galaxy into the cap space that Nashville are holding, or if that cap space is just going to be used to absorb MLS Cup bonuses. Because I think one of the things that Vanny found very difficult in Toronto and very frustrating in Toronto was they had to blow that team up pretty much right away because they had no wiggle room to absorb all the MLS Cup bonuses the next year. So I'm curious if this is a Brugman is a sacrificial lamb to keep everybody else, or if there is an associated move coming. Ben, do you like this one?
Actually really like this one, and I think it's one of those things where you there's going to be some caveats here because you have to read between the lines a bit, because Brugman is obviously excellent. He's got great numbers. He was a huge contributor for the Galaxy in good games this season and in bad games in previous seasons. So Nashville's clearly getting a great player, and it's one of those things where the Galaxy are forced to make a move, and I think this is a good move to make because they're saving on Davis's salary, which is, I think, probably more than the value he brings in terms of like a per minute per goal type of metric. But I think he gives Galaxy something they didn't have before, where, Brugman wasn't playing towards the end of the season because Cirillo had taken that spot and was doing so well with it. So I think if you have a different type of central midfielder compared to like Delgado or Cirillo, who do that more possession style, but if you just need to hold a lead, now you can put Sean Davis in. You know he's not going to lose the ball. You know he can tackle hard. You know he's not going to be out of position. And he's that type of reliable player in the middle that I don't know if they had before. So I think they lose a great player, but I think they get something that they didn't have, and they offload cap space in a way that minimizes the hit they're getting from losing such a good player.
Ben, what's your number? You guys give us a four. I'd call it like a five slash incomplete.
I give it a 7.
Oh, Ben, very positive.
I'm hot on it.
Here's one I think we will not like as a group. Red Bull is signing Erik-Maxim Choupo-Moting as a designated player. Nikos, give us a rating.
Let's go two.
Two. Ben, what do you have?
I was thinking 2 as well.
I don't get it.
I don't get it.
I don't get it. Like, I don't see any of the benefit here, really.
I mean, he's not an outright bad player, so that's why it's not a one. But, like, when the initial reporting was like, okay, Red Bull are signing Choupo-Moting, it's like, okay, veteran striker, like, maybe like a 1 year deal, damn deal, maybe if they get a little bit aggressive, I'm like, okay, that's fine. Like, obviously played at a very high level, used to coming off the bench, can be really helpful for a very young team. And it's like, no, it's actually 2 years and a designated player deal. It's like, but why though? Why, out of all the players that you could have signed, why him? He can't even really press that well anymore because he's too old.
I mean, he's collectively in his last 5 seasons has played 30 90s. Like, this is not a guy who's going to cover the hard yards in July for you. It's very, I thought, I had the same reaction as you, where I thought, oh, you know what? As like a guy who's going to play half the minutes for you in games that you expect to be the better team, Like he's going to be a guy you can get in the box and he'll get you good shots and he'll score a fair few goals. But this is not what that deal has ended up being.
No, and in general, I am always very skeptical of guys who are substitutions mostly. That was his role. Like he was always an impact sub behind very, very good strikers, which makes sense. Like he doesn't cost that lot cost a lot for like relative like Bayern Munich. And of course, if you already have very good strikers, you don't want to spend a lot of money on the backup because the good striker is going to play all the time. So that's his role. And now he comes to Red Bull and he has to start every game, really. That's what you want from a designated player. And I'm always very, very skeptical of guys like that. It reminds me a little bit in a smaller way with Shaqiri, who was a very good impact sub, and suddenly he had to carry the team, which he had never done before. Like the last time that Choupo-Moting was like a starter, it's a very long time ago. Like, and even like mentally, that's a different role.
Yeah,
Like you have to carry the team now.
2017, 2018 for Stoke was the last time he cleared 2090s in a season. Just yeah,
Shaqiri may have been on that team.
honestly, he almost certainly was.
May
Last
also have been the
deal.
last time Shaqiri was a starter before he got his DP deal.
The only team Shaqiri has carried is Switzerland.
Yes.
Last deal, another big GAM trade, Leo Campana from Miami to the Revs for 2 million in 2025 GAM, 500K in 2026 GAM. I like this for the Revs. Like, you have a ton of GAM because you sold Bayraktarevic, who was a wildly unproductive player, for a ton of money. It's basically all of the GAM you got from that sale. So I don't know how I feel about that, but turning him into Campana, who has scored at a pretty solid rate in MLS, I think is a good move. Like, I would call this a win-win both ways, I think. Like, Miami needed the GAM. He didn't play that much for them. They will do more useful things than he was in his minutes, I think. But also, I think this is pretty nice for the Revs. Ben, how do you feel about this one?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I think it's my initial take when I saw that was like, whoa, 2 million GAM. And I think part of it, maybe there's GAM inflation going on with all the new teams that have come in the last recent years. I feel like that may have pushed prices up. Now there's new mechanisms to get GAM. Sales are getting more common. So I feel like these trades just have gotten more expensive. So I feel like being able to move off of a risky type of speculative signing, which was the definition of Bayraktarevic, for not losing money there and turning, like you're saying, Nikos, like a U22 player who d isn't going to help you win into a player that will definitely help you win and has already helped Miami win and it helped Miami set the points record. I think that's a great move.
Yeah, my initial thought was also that is quite an aggressive trade. Like I think it's like the league record. And it's like Leo Campana league record trade. That doesn't feel entirely right to me. Like he's not that level of player, but he is like I think at least an above average starter in this league, and he's also still quite young. I think he's entering his peak age, I believe. So yeah, I think I quite like that for New England, who do not have a lot of talent at the moment, and just locking in a player like that, like it's I think a very good use for your GAM. Like essentially, as you mentioned, bottom line, effectively swapping Bayraktarevic for Campana is a massive upgrade. So it's, I quite like that. For the perspective of New England, I would say 8.
And he's on a great contract too, like 600K a year until 2027. Like, that's you're super fine with playing a 75th percentile striker or whatever that every year. And he's
And if,
24, like, you're pretty happy with that.
yeah, on that contract, if you're not paying the GAM to, bring down his cap hit, you might as well be paying the GAM to get him on the roster in the first place. So it makes
Yeah,
sense that from that
it's fine if you
perspective.
think about that. Like, let's say his production is a $1 million a year player. it's basically paying down like half of the fee or three quarters of the fee is would be the equivalent of paying him down from 1 million to 600K. It's a weird way to think about that.
Or reverse amortizing like GAM that you won't be paying on that contract in future years. Pay that up front. Now you got that GAM back to work
Well,
with.
and
Bless the
they're
players out.
bad now, right? So like you should,
Yeah,
if
you
you're
need to be
bad,
winning.
well, if you're bad now, you should be using your GAM now to buy future wins because the wins you buy now don't matter. You're not good enough for them to be useful. Whereas Miami are the opposite. They need GAM now rather than future GAM.
Yes, and again, like a lot of strikers are also designated players. And how much does it cost you to buy an outside player as a DP to get like a 70th percentile striker? That is a lot more than like 2 million a game.
For sure. For sure. Well, we are going to call it there. If you want to support the show, you want to support the website, check out the Patreon that I shouted out earlier. You get access to the fun tools. You get the trade machine. You get the roster builder. You also get the season simulator, which is a little thing we were doing stuff through the playoffs, checking to see if this player plays. It was fun to do, like we did for the final when Pooj was confirmed out, like Galaxy's winning probability dropped 10%, which was quite wild. And it was just cool to do little things like that. So if you want access to the tools, that's the way to get it. Nikos, thank you for coming on. Anything you want to plug before we let you go?
Not really, no. I don't
No.
sell products like you guys. I don't have a Patreon.
Okay. Well, if you want to get in contact with Nico, what's the best way if people want to ask you questions if they want to get in contact?
Just send me a direct message on Blue Sky or connect with me on LinkedIn. That's fine.
Okay. All righty. Well, Blue Sky. Yeah, we're loving the Blue Sky. Much more fun place than Twitter. Thank you all for joining me. As always, enjoy the soccer.